You. Something is off in the way Tessa is looking at me, like she's trying to hide her disappointment. I'm not sure what to make of this. My guess is because she misses Harden, but I'm probably wrong. I haven't got a clue what to think about any of this. Instead of indulging in gossip that may or may not be worth it, I tighten the drawstring on my sweats and head toward the door. "We aren't done here, Landon Gibson," Tessa shouts after me. And somehow it all makes me feel a little like a criminal on the run.
Chapter 9. I close the apartment door behind me and nearly slam into someone in the hallway. When his hood falls down, I don't recognize him. He's wearing a black coat and gray windbreaker pants. He nods at me, being friendly enough, and lifts his hood back over his head. Our apartment building has about 20 units, and I've seen nearly every person or couple who lives here, but not this guy. Maybe he just moved in. "Excuse me, sorry," I say as I move out of his way, but he just grunts in reply. At the corner of the block, I break out into a run. I wait for the ache to resurface in my knee, and it does, but it's bearable now. The low, simmering pain is no longer a sharp throb. I pick up my pace. My Nikes hit the sidewalk with hardly any noise at all. I remember when I first started running and my legs would burn and my chest would feel like it was going to explode. I pushed and pushed. I needed to be healthy. And now I am. Not healthy like the stroller moms in Brooklyn who take shots of wheatgrass for breakfast and feed their babies kale and quinoa for lunch, but healthy insofar as being active. I often empty my mind when I run, though sometimes I think about my mom and the baby, about Tessa and Harden, or I stew with frustration if the Chicago Blackhawks beat the Detroit Red Wings. Today, I feel like I have a lot on my mind. First, Dakota's behavior. She's barely spoken to me since she broke up with me, and now she's acting like we will see each other every day. She was so worked up over her audition, and I wish there was something I could do. I can't go to one of the most prestigious ballet academies in the country and knock on their door claiming racial discrimination without any proof, especially with all the madness going on in the country already. The last thing that I want to do is to cause Dakota to get too much negative attention while she's trying to start a career there. The shit that I'm used to helping her with is so different from this. Her career is something that I absolutely can't do anything about. The obstacles that we used to battle together seem so distant now, a part of our past. Our problems felt much heavier back then, much more immediate. I don't know what to do with practical day-to-day problems like school or career choices. This is one of the few times that I would like to be Harden for about an hour. I would rush down to that academy, pound on the door, and demand justice for her. I would convince them that Dakota is the best ballerina they have there, that despite her reminders that she's not a ballerina yet, she is indispensable to them. The best. Ballet to Dakota is what hockey is for me, only 10 times more so because she actually does it. My school didn't offer hockey as a sport, and when my mom signed me up to play at the local rec center, it was the worst 2 hours of my life. I learned very quickly that hockey is a sport I can love to watch and never play. Dakota has been dancing since she was a kid. She started with hip-hop, moved to jazz, and settled on ballet in her teens. Believe it or not, beginning ballet as a teen is a huge disadvantage, and in some circles is considered to be too late. But Dakota smashed those assumptions during her first audition at the School of American Ballet. My mom sent her the money to go to the audition for her birthday present. She cried grateful tears and promised my mom that she would do her best to pay her generosity back someday. My mom didn't want to be paid back. She wanted to see the sweet neighbor girl rise above her circumstances and make something of herself. The day she learned of her acceptance, Dakota came running through the house with her letter waving above her head. She was screaming and jumping, and I had to pick her up and flip her small body upside down to get her to stay still. She was so happy. I was so proud. Her school may not be Joffrey, but it's a highly rated academy, and I'm damned proud of her. All I want is for her to be happy and for her talent to be recognized. I want to fix this for her, but it's out of my control. As frustrating as it is, I can't think of one realistic solution to this problem. I should have asked her what else was going on. There has to be more to work with. I file that away for later and shift my focus to Nora. She does look more like a Nora than a Sophia, and luckily I'm not as bad as Hardin with names. He refuses to call Dakota anything other than Delilah, even to her face. Enough about brooding Hardy. Hardy? That makes me laugh. I'm calling him that next time he calls Dakota Delilah. As I pass a grocery mart, a woman with her hands full of paper bags is staring at me, so I stop laughing at myself and my corny plans to stick it to Hardin. Or Hardy. I laugh again. I need more coffee. I'm only about a 20-minute run from Grind, but it's the opposite direction from my apartment than the park. Coffee is worth it. You can get coffee on nearly every corner here, but not good coffee. Ugh, deli coffee is the worst. And I need to check if next week's schedule is up anyway. I reverse course and run back toward the coffee shop. I pass the woman carrying the shopping bags again, and I watch as one of the sacks slips from her hand. I rush over to help, but I'm not fast enough, and the brown bag tears and cans of food roll onto the sidewalk. She looks so frustrated that it wouldn't be a surprise if she screamed at me just for helping her. I grab a can of chicken soup before it rolls into the street. Another bag tears, and she curses as her vegetables tumble to the ground. Her dark hair is covering her face, but I would guess she's about 30. She's wearing a loose dress and has a slight bump underneath. She may be pregnant. Or she may not be. I know better than to ask. Two teenage boys cross the street and come our way. For just a moment, I believe they may actually help us. Nope. While we're scrambling to clean up her grocery disaster, they don't bat an eye in our direction. No neighborly assistance, they just pick up their boots and are nice enough to step over a box of rice directly in their path. Sometimes not crushing things in your way is as much kindness as you can get in this city. Do you live far from here? I ask the woman. She looks up from the sidewalk and shakes her head.
No, just one more block.
She pushes deep brown hands against her hair and groans in frustration. I point to the pile of groceries from the two bags. Okay. Let's get these under control. Seeing as I don't have any extra bags hanging around in my pockets, I pull my sweatshirt over my head and start scooping the groceries into it. They may not all fit, but it's worth a try.
Thanks,
she offers, slightly out of breath. She moves to Ben to help me, but I stop her. A car honks, then another. I barely have one foot in the street, but they honk anyway. The best thing about living in Brooklyn is the lack of honking, usually. Manhattan is a chaotic, angry little island, but I could possibly see myself settling down in Brooklyn, teaching at a public school and raising my family. My daydream plans usually include other cities, quieter ones. Still, I've got to get a girl to go on a date with me first, so this may take a while. Let's just say it's my 5-year plan. Okay, 10-year plan. I push a bottle of cooking oil into the crook of my arm. I've got it, it's fine, I tell the woman. I look into her hooded eyes. She's watching me now, skeptical and unsure whether I'm sketchy or okay. You can trust me, I want to promise her. However, chances are that if I say that, it will only raise her suspicion levels. The wind picks up, instantly bringing the temperature down a bit. I move faster, and once I get most of the groceries inside my sweatshirt, I tie the sleeves together, creating my best version of a bag. I toss in a box of crackers and a pack of lunch meat. I stand to my feet and place the sweatshirt bag in her hands. Her eyes soften. You can keep the hoodie, I have a ton of them, I say.
I bet you'll make a lady very happy one day, young man,
she says to me with a smile. She gathers up the remainder of her grocery bags that didn't break, readjusts the sweatshirt in her arms, and starts to walk away. I'm flattered by her compliment, but I quickly wonder why she assumed that I'm single. Do I ooze desperation and loneliness? Probably. Do you need help? I can help you get them home, I offer, sure to pose my tone as an offer, not a demand. It's going to take her a while to get home carrying those bags like that. She shakes her head and looks past me in the direction she was headed.
It's just right here, I've got it.
I hear a tinge of an accent in her voice, but I can't make it out. As she walks away, it dawns on me that she actually doesn't need my help. She's carrying the bags and the sweatshirt full of groceries just fine. I'm guessing this is supposed to be some metaphor sent by the cosmic forces to show me that I don't have to help everyone, like Augustus and his cigarettes in The Fault in Our Stars. Well, not exactly the same, but still. He obviously had it worse than me, poor guy. I let the woman go on her own and continue my journey south, deeper into Bushwick. I love the neighborhood I live in. It's close to the cool things in Williamsburg, but with much lower rent. Definitely our rent is already high. It shocked the heck out of me when I moved here, and is basically more than my mom's mortgage. But if the cool factor of our neighborhood keeps rising, it will double in no time. Still, things aren't as expensive here as I thought they would be. They're not cheap, by any means, but those rumors of a gallon of milk costing $10 in New York City aren't true. For the most part. The Russian guy who owns the corner store below my apartment does like to hike his prices, but I suppose I'm paying extra for the convenience of being able to get down there in under a minute. I could always walk 2 more minutes and find another. One of the best things about the city is the endless options. From corner stores to restaurants to people, there's always another option. Chapter 10. When I get to grind, Posey is behind the counter pouring a bucket of ice into the bin. Jane, the shop's oldest employee, who sometimes likes to call herself the elder statesman in a corny little voice, is cleaning the stained wood floors. She dips the mop into the bucket and soapy water overflows. A little girl gets up from a table near the back and walks over to watch Jane as she swipes the mop over the mess, soaking up the water. I look around the various tables for her parents, but the shop is pretty empty. Out of the 10 tables, only 2 are occupied. 2 girls with their laptops and textbooks filling the table and a guy with 4 empty espresso cups are the only people I see. Noticing me, Posey greets me with a silent smile. The little girl, who looks to be about 4, sits down on the floor and pulls something out of her pocket. A small red car wheels across the puddle, and I watch her eyes light up. Jane says something to her that I can't make out.
Lila, please don't do that.
Posey lifts the partition and steps out from behind the counter. Approaching the little girl, she bends down to her level. The little girl grabs the red car before Posey can reach it. She hugs it to her chest and shakes her head furiously.
Want car?
Her little voice chimes. Posey reaches her hand out and cups the girl's cheek. Her thumb caresses the child's skin and turns her panic into comfort. She must be familiar with Posey. Her sister, of course. This little brown-haired girl must be the sister she's mentioned a few times.
You can keep the car, but please don't put it in the water.
Posey's voice is different when she talks to the girl, softer.
Okay?
Posey taps the little girl on the nose and she giggles. She's cute.
Kay?
Her little voice is even cuter. I walk toward them and sit down at a nearby table. Jane finishes with 1 more swipe of her mop and says hi before she excuses herself to go to the stockroom to finish inventory. Posey looks around to assess how busy the store is, politely checks in on the 2 tables, then walks back over to the girl and me.
Please don't tell Jacob that I brought her to work with me.
Posey slides into the chair in front of me. I would never, I tell her with a smile. Jacob can be an ass. He's just a little too young to be a manager, and is the type of guy that, when given just a taste of power, he runs with it. He's a little too bossy and a little bit of a douchebag.
My grandma had an appointment and I couldn't call in.
Posey nervously justifies herself. Well, lucky for you then, you get to hang out with your sister all day. Posey smiles and nods in agreement, relief clear on her face. Little Lila doesn't turn to look toward my voice. The bell on the door chimes, alerting Posey of a customer. She looks at Lila and I nod, telling her I can sit with the girl. Going back behind the counter, Posey greets 2 men in suits, and I turn to watch the little girl play with her toy. She's not paying any attention to me. That car is fascinating her, and she's awfully cute while she rolls the little Camaro along the uneven floor. She crawls behind it, despite being clearly old enough to walk. Her little sneakers light up when her toes hit the floor, and her little fingers wrap around the body of the car, which she flips over and spins upside down, smiling all the while. "That's an awfully cool car you've got yourself," I tell her. She doesn't look up at me, but she speaks. "Car," she says. Posey looks over as she pours soy milk from a carton into the blender. I smile at her, and her shoulders relax. She purses her lips into a modest smile and gets back to work. Her fingernails are dark with little yellow dots painted on them. I watch her hands as she pours pre-made green tea from a pitcher into the cup full of soy milk and ice. She blends the concoction and sways her head back and forth to the Coldplay song playing on our speakers. I look back over to the little girl staring adoringly at her little plastic Camaro. "Zoom," Lila says softly. She lifts the car into the air and gazes off into the distance after it. I sit quietly until the customers disappear. Posey is wiping down the bottles of flavored syrup with a wet rag. The tables are dirty, 8 out of 10 of them. I walk over to the trash area and grab the busser tub from inside the cabinet next to the trash can. Lila is still saying car and zoom as I start to clear off the first table. A $3 tip. Not too bad. You'd be surprised at the number of customers that leave their tables a mess but don't think to leave a tip for the person cleaning it up. I'm not sure if it's rudeness or if it's just ignorance. Like Uber drivers. We assume that they get their entire tip, which is charged automatically. But I've heard people say it's not. Even if you mark the 15% tab, they don't actually see that money. So this one guy in my class told me you're supposed to tip them in cash. Then again, he said he was from France, but his accent was clearly German, so the possibility of him lying is probably fairly high. Either way, baristas should be tipped way more than they are. Public service announcement complete. Moving on. The next table has at least 4 sugar packets emptied out into a pile. I'm impressed when I see the sugar packets folded into little stick figures. There's a toothpick with a piece of napkin for a flag stuck right into the center of the sugar hill. I try to remember what the guy looked like who was sitting here. Actually, I think it was a girl. Or woman. I didn't get a clear look at her face. But whoever she is, she's clearly an awesome force in the miniature sugar sculpture scene. "Lila," I call to get the little girl's attention. She looks up but doesn't move her body from its now full-on lying down position on the floor. "Do you want to come see this little scene over here? It's pretty cool." I point to the sugar hill and stare at the fake sword in one of the sugar packet people's arm. A hearty "no" comes out of her mouth, and I nod, not entirely surprised, flattening the hill with my washcloth. I go back and forth between clearing the remaining tables and keeping an eye on Lila. As I'm taking a last swipe over the second-to-last table, Posey walks from behind the counter and stands in front of me. "You didn't have to do that," she says. The brown of her eyes is barely noticeable because of how bloodshot they are. "It's your day off." "Are you okay?" I ask. She glances around the shop and nods, sighing as she sits down at the table closest to her sister. She shrugs. "Just tired. Work, school, the usual." Her smile is perky still, despite her words. She doesn't like to complain, I can tell, even though she totally has reason to, or to at least vent. "If you need to have some shifts picked up or anything, let me know. I don't mind helping, and I have some free time this semester." I actually don't have that much free time, but I would like to help her if I can. She clearly has more going on than I do. Posey shakes her head, and her cheeks flush. Light red strands are escaping from the tiny black elastic band that's too small to hold her hair. In the light, her hair looks lighter, as if she dyed it red. Her complexion doesn't give any of her secrets away. "I need the shifts, but if you know anyone who makes bubbles to put little 4-year-old daredevils inside of while I work, let me know." I smile with her and look at Lila, who is still lying on the floor. "She's autistic," she says. Somewhere inside my head, the pieces were put together within a few minutes of meeting her. We aren't sure how severe yet. She's learning to talk now. She pauses briefly. At 4. Well, sometimes that's not such a bad thing. I gently bump her shoulder with mine, trying to find a dash of humor in something so scary. She uncrosses her arms and her face relaxes into a wide smile. True. She presses her fingers against her lips. Posey bends down closer to her little sister and rests her hands on her knees. I can't hear what she says, but I can see that it makes Lila happy. I check the time. It's close to 6. If I'm going to go out with Nora and her friends, I need to get back to my apartment and shower. I'm not nervous, really. I just don't know what she's thinking about me. Does she randomly kiss people often? If so, that's okay. But I wish I had some inkling of what she's feeling. Or how she acts on a date. She'd been flirty before today. Well, I'd take it as her flirting, but so far she hadn't given me any indication or warning that she was open to kissing me like she did this morning. She was so confident when she leaned into me, pressing into me, running her hands over my chest. Remembering the way her tongue tasted makes my cock ache. I need to do something about it, and this time I won't rip the shower curtain and fall on my ass and cut my face and bruise my knee. Safe sex. I'll stay safely in my bed, with my door locked. I'll even push my dresser against the door. I look over at Posey, who's sitting back at the table again. She has her phone next to her ear and is frowning. I watch her shake her head and mutter something into the phone before hanging up. I want to be nosy, to ask her if she's okay, but at the same time, I don't want to pry into her life without her wanting me to. Do you need anything before I go? I ask while I walk behind the bar to check my schedule and make my espresso. Double espresso. I consider doing a triple, but that might not be the best idea. Posey's shift should be close to over by now. She shakes her head, thanking me, but says she's fine. I wave goodbye to Lila and Posey, shouting goodbye to Jane loud enough for her to hear me from the stockroom. Chapter 11. As I push on the heavy shop door and walk out into the coming night, my phone pings in my front pocket. Heavy bags of trash line the street, nearly bursting open to spill their litter onto the sidewalks. It's the same every day, but I don't see myself getting used to it. Manhattan must be even worse, with all the shops and 1.5 million people sharing the smaller space. It's an impossible city to live in if you don't want to be bumped into, honked at, or hassled. It astounds me that so many people can be shoved into so many little apartments with tiny windows and tiny kitchens. The rooms in my place are bigger than I had expected. The bathroom is snug. But I knew I couldn't afford to live in an expensive place in Brooklyn that was any bigger than 500 square feet. My stepdad, Ken, helps pay our rent. But I've been putting money aside since I got a job, and I plan on repaying him someday, at least some of it. I'm not very comfortable with the idea of him helping me with my bills. I'm responsible enough, partly thanks to him and his lectures about money management and student expenses. I don't blow my money on booze or going out. I pay my bills and occasionally buy books or tickets to a hockey game. Having a parent who occupies such a high position at a university has unquestionably made my college life 100% easier. I got help with each and every form. I had a helping hand in choosing all my classes, and I managed to get into some that were supposedly full. Ken had a lot more pull at Washington Central than at NYU, for sure, but it still helps to know the ins and outs of admissions departments. I often think about how life would be if my mom had stayed in Michigan. Would I have left her alone there and moved to New York with Dakota? I feel like I would have been less likely to move if she didn't have Ken and her group of friends in Washington. My life would be so different if she hadn't met him. Sometimes I think that outside of a few obvious things, New York City isn't that different from Saginaw. The sun is often hidden in Manhattan, keeping the light from the city's residents in a small box on a beach somewhere on the West Coast. I've become so used to the overcast sky shadowing every town I've ever lived in that when the sun shines here in Brooklyn, my eyes burn for half of my walk to work. I bought a pair of sunglasses, which I quickly lost.
but the sun shows its face in Brooklyn often enough that I would actually use them, marking one of the many reasons I chose to live here instead of Manhattan. In September, the overcast has blotted out everything close to the skyline. The farther you get away from the towering buildings, the more luminous the sun becomes. A short, stocky bundle of layered coats with a hat on top moves past me on the sidewalk, the man beneath them pushing a shopping cart full of aluminum cans and plastic bottles. His hands are encased in thick, faded brown gloves covered in black dirt. Patches of gray hair poke out from under the red and green plaid hat he's wearing, and his eyes are half closed, like time and hardship have wilted him to the point of near collapse. He stares straight ahead, paying me no mind, but my heart aches for him. To me, the poverty in some parts of the city is the hardest thing to deal with. I miss my mom, but seeing the sad, shameful look on the weathered face of a middle-aged man sitting against a bank window using the words printed on a piece of cardboard to beg for food money, that kind of thing is especially hard for me. Even so, it must cut even deeper for men like that to be leaning against a building that is home to millions of dollars. To watch, with an empty stomach, as groups of suits walk past on their lunch break and spend $20 on a grain salad while they are starving. Saginaw doesn't have a large population of homeless. Most of the city's poor have homes. The siding on their old homes is almost collapsing, the walls are rotting with mold, and the beds are infested with little bugs that feed on them in their sleep. But they have roofs over their heads. Most of the people I know in Saginaw try and try to get ahead. But it's hard there. All of my friends' parents were farmers or lifelong factory workers. But since all the factories closed over the past decade, there just aren't any jobs. Outside of heroin, the city can't boast of any growth industries. Families that were doing well 10 years ago can barely put food on the table now. Unemployment rates are at an all-time high, along with the crime rate and drug problems. The happiness ran away with the jobs, and sometimes I think neither will ever return. That's the biggest difference between my hometown and this city. The hope that buzzes through New York City makes all the difference in the world. Millions of people move to the biggest city in the entire country based solely on this emotion. They hope for more. They hope for more happiness, more opportunity, more experience, and most of all, more money. The streets are crowded with people who leave their native countries and build a home and a life for their families here. It's pretty amazing when you think about it. People pack up and move here, some crazy statistic like over 100 people a day. 24-hour subways, heck, 24-hour services of every category. And no large pickups or tractors taking up half of the road like in Michigan. The small brown municipal buildings that we call downtown Saginaw aren't even close in comparison to the soaring skyscrapers in New York City. So the more and more I think about it, New York and Saginaw have absolutely nothing in common, and I think I'm okay with that. Maybe I keep trying to make them similar to try to reassure myself that living here won't change me. That whatever growing up means, I will still be myself when I get there. Only different. My phone pings again. Pulling it out, I see my mom's name twice, making my heart race. When I read the messages, I relax. One of them is a link to an article about a Harry Potter-themed bar that just opened in Toronto, and the other is an update on my little sister's weight. She's a little one so far, but my mom still has 4 weeks to go. The last month should give little Abby enough time to bulk up in there. The thought of my wrinkly little baby sister wearing a pink headband while lifting little pudgy arms into the air makes me laugh. I don't know how it will be to be a big brother, especially at my age. I'm too old to possibly have anything in common with the little one, but I want to be the best brother I can be. I want to be the older brother that I needed when I was young. It will be an adjustment for my mom and for Ken to have such a young baby at home again when both of their other children are grown and finally out of the nest. My mom kept telling me that she couldn't wait to have the house to herself, but I could tell she would be lonely without me around. It's always been her and me, through the best and the worst.
As I wait for the crosswalk sign to change and show that glowing white silhouette, I remind myself how damn lucky I am to have the mom I do. She never once questioned my move and has supported every one of my whims since I was a child. My mom was that mom who would dress up in costumes with me months away from Halloween. She even told me I could live on the moon if I wanted to. When I was a child, I often wondered if I ran fast enough if I would land on the moon. Sometimes, I wished I would. When the light changes, a woman in high heels struggles to cross the street before me. I don't understand why women put themselves through so much torture to look taller. The intersections here change quickly, usually giving pedestrians less than 30 seconds to cross. I type a quick response to my mom and promise to call her tonight. I shove my phone back in my pocket, deciding to read about the bar later. I really want to go to Toronto. I always have, and a flight from here is only an hour, so maybe I can plan a trip over winter break. I'll most likely go alone, even though a wild part of me suddenly suggests that I take Nora. She would be fun to travel with, I bet. I have a feeling she's traveled more than I have. Even without knowing her, I see her as someone who's been a few places, or just knows more about the world in general than me. There's only so much a textbook can teach you. I'm proof of this. I would love to travel, and soon. But why am I imagining Nora and me on some tropical beach somewhere, imagining her in a tiny bikini top, her full ass peeking out from the bottom? I barely know her, and yet I can't get her out of my head. The deli below my building is never crowded, and sometimes I feel bad for Ellen, the young Russian girl who works behind the counter. It worries me that she sits in there all alone at night. The bell above the door rings as I enter, and Ellen pops her head up from a thick textbook and gives me a polite smile. Her short, wavy hair is tucked behind a thin headband that matches her red sweater with small white dots. "Hi there," she says to me as I scan the refrigerated section in the back for milk. "Hey, Ellen," I say. Grabbing a container of milk, I check the dates because I've left here with expired products more than once. Then I search for a blue Gatorade to grab for Nora the next time she comes over, but they don't have any. I have time, so I'll just walk down to the next closest store after I leave here. And for the second time today, I find I could have used one of the tote bags Tessa keeps a supply of near the door. She likes to discourage the use of plastic, and now every time I open the door, I hear her voice reminding me of the damage plastic bags wreak on the environment. That woman watches way too many documentaries. Soon she's going to boycott wearing shoes or something. Ellen closes her textbook as I approach. I grab a pack of gum from the shelf in front of the counter. She looks a little stressed, so now I really wish I had brought a tote. The one with a watermelon and a cantaloupe on it. Next to the watermelon is a text bubble that says, "We should run away and get married." And the cantaloupe replies, "I'm sorry." And underneath that, the cantaloupe's face is larger and it's saying, "I cantaloupe." Ellen finds the fruit humor just as funny as I do, which makes her quality people. And maybe a joke would make her smile. "How's it going?" I ask.
"Good, just studying."
The old register beeps when Ellen types in the cost of the milk and gum. I pull my card out and swipe it. "You're always studying," I say. "It's true. Every time I come here, she's alone behind the counter and is either reading from a textbook or filling out worksheets."
"I need to get into college," she shrugs, and her brown eyes flash away from mine.
"College? She's in high school and works here this late and this often?" Even on the days when I don't stop in, I see her working through the window. "How old are you?" I can't help but ask. It's none of my business, and I'm not much older than her. But if I were her parents, I would be a little worried about my teenage daughter working alone, at night, in a store in Brooklyn. "I turn 17 next week," she says with a frown, which kind of runs counter to the typical teenage girl who beams at the idea of getting another year closer to the golden age of 18. "Nice," I tell her as she hands me the receipt to sign. She's still frowning when she hands me a red pen tied to a small clipboard with a dirty brown string. I sign it and give it back to her.
She apologizes profusely when the printer machine jams before my copy of the receipt comes out. She pops off the top, and I tell her that it's fine. I'm not in a rush, I tell her. I don't have anywhere to be except home to study for geology. Oh, and my date with Nora that I'm pretty damn nervous about. No big deal. She rips the jammed paper roll out and tosses it into the trash can behind the counter. Thinking about her, I realize that Ellen has never really seemed as carefree as a 17-year-old should be. Often I forget that most people in the world don't have a mom like mine. Heck, most kids I knew growing up didn't. I didn't have a father figure growing up, but it never bothered me much, honestly. I had my mom. Everyone reacts to things differently based on their own personal experience and how they're built. Harden, for example, his experiences had different effects on him than mine had on me, and he had to take a different path to understand them. It doesn't matter why. What matters is that he's taken responsibility for them and is busting his ass to understand his past and shape his future. When I was 12, I began to count down the years and months leading to my 18th birthday. Even though I wouldn't be going anywhere right away, my 18th birthday being right at the beginning of my senior year, because of the enrollment cutoff, I was always older than everyone else in my grade. I hadn't planned on leaving my mom's house until after college. But that was before Dakota started mentioning me moving to New York with her during her senior year. After I spent months applying for a transfer, applying for FAFSA at NYU, finding an apartment for the two of us that was easily accessible to the campus using the subway, coming to peace with leaving behind my best friends, my pregnant mom, and my stepdad, Dakota's life took a change and she forgot to tell me. I'm still happy that I moved. Happy that I'm becoming an actual man who's socially aware with responsibilities and plans for the future. I'm not perfect. I can barely do my own laundry, and I'm still getting the hang of paying my own bills, but I'm learning at a pace that I can keep up with and having a good time doing it. Tessa helps a lot. Tessa likes to keep things much tidier than a normal person, but we both clean and do an equal share of the chores. I've never left a dirty pair of socks in the living room or forgotten to pick up my damp, dirty clothes off the bathroom floor after a shower. I'm conscious that I share an apartment with a woman who I'm not intimate with, so I never leave the toilet seat up or freak out if I see a tampon wrapper in the trash can. I make sure she's not home when I masturbate, and I always make sure to leave no evidence behind when I do. Though perhaps yesterday disproves that last claim, my mind keeps going back there to the encounter with Nora. After turning the machine off and back on and changing the roll of paper twice, Ellen prints my copy of the receipt. I decide to linger just a little longer. I have a feeling that she doesn't get much interaction outside of the characters in her history books. Are you doing anything special for your birthday? I ask her, genuinely curious. She scoffs and her cheeks flare. Her pale skin turns red and she shakes her head. Me? No, I have to work. Somehow I knew she didn't have plans outside of sitting in a stool behind the high counter. Well, birthdays are overrated anyway, I say with the biggest smile I can manage. She half smiles, her eyes lighting up with just a touch of happiness. Her back straightens slightly and her shoulders sag a little less. Yeah, they are. I tell her to have a good night, and she says she will. As I close the door behind me, I tell her not to study too hard. Man, what would it be like to be 17 and growing up in the city? I can't really imagine it. During my walk to the store at the end of the block, I read about the bar my mom texted me about, and call her. She tells me that Ken just got home from a conference in Portland, and he hops on the line so we can talk about the score of the last Giants game. With their loss, I won a little wager we had going, and I can't keep myself from bragging just a touch. We play quick catch-up and get off the phone so he and my mom can eat dinner. I used to eat dinner with them nearly every night and talk about current events, school, sports, among other things. While I'm glad for the time I spent with my family before I moved, thinking about them only reminds me all the more that I've got to make some friends. Chapter 12. After finding not one, but three red Gatorades, I head back to my apartment. At my building, a loud delivery truck is idling in the middle of the street. The deli below the building has deliveries at all times of the night. The trash collectors come around 3 a.m. nearly every night, and the loud pounding of the bins being emptied into the metal truck used to wake me up all the time. I recently made the best purchase of my life and got one of those machines that play sounds of the sea, the rainforest, the night desert, and the only setting that I actually use, white noise. I wait patiently for the elevator to reach the first floor and step inside. It's small, only suitable for two medium-sized people and one shopping bag. I usually don't mind taking the stairs, but my knees started throbbing a little again. As it lifts me to the third floor, the elevator creaks and groans, and those sounds, along with my anxiety about tonight, make me wonder when one of the old elevators in this city is finally going to trap me for hours. If it happened tonight, I wouldn't be able to go out with Nora. No, tonight will be fun. It will be so fun, I tell myself as I put the milk away and the Gatorade in the fridge. It's a normal thing to go out with a woman and her roommates, even if I don't know them, I think, as I feel the soothing hot water of the shower. An uneventful shower during which no curtains or egos are hurt. And one that I very much enjoy. Totally normal, and nothing to be nervous about. But the moment I convince myself of this, a tiny, curly-haired wrench is tossed into my plans. Lying back on my bed, my hair still wet from the shower, I check my text messages. I scroll through two texts, one from Tessa about taking an extra shift. She says she will meet us out if she can, and that Nora is going to text me soon with the information about tonight. The other is from Dakota. "Hey, what are you up to?" I read, then repeat it aloud, a little confused. Staring at the screen, I wait for a few moments before responding. I don't want to tell her that I have plans with someone else, especially not another woman. It's not that I want to lie. I would rather do anything than that. I just don't see anything good coming from telling her what I'm actually doing. I don't know if there's even a reason to tell her. We aren't dating. Nora and I are only friends, no matter how much time I spend thinking about her. But I lie anyway. Studying? You? I close my eyes before I hit send, and my memory guides my thumb to pull the trigger. I immediately feel guilty for lying, but know that it's too late to backtrack now. I plug my phone into the charger and walk to my closet to begin getting ready for tonight. I grab a pair of dark blue jeans with rips in both knees from my closet. The jeans are tighter than I usually wear, but I like the way they look on me. Until 2 years ago, I would have never fit into these without looking like an overflowing cupcake. Not even a cupcake. A muffin. An ugly muffin. I stare and stare at my closet, trying to locate any bit of fashion knowledge I may have stored somewhere inside my brain. There's nothing. I've got elves, wizards, hockey pucks, and plenty of warlocks inside my head, but no fashion tips. There's nothing in my closet except button-down shirts, plaid everything, and too many WCU hoodies. I walk over to my small dresser and open the top drawer. I'll wear gray briefs, one of the few pairs I have that don't have holes in them. My room is a little muggy, so I lean over and pull my window open. The second drawer is filled with t-shirts, most of them with words printed on the front. Should I have gone shopping? Where is Tessa when I need her? Getting ready to go out for a night of partying is something I'm not even close to being familiar with. I usually wear plain t-shirts with jeans or slacks, and since I've moved to Brooklyn, I've added a few jackets to my wardrobe. I would say I'm right in the middle stages of being able to dress myself. I don't know what type of place we're going to, or what Nora will be wearing. I don't know much about dates in general. I reach for a gray shirt and toss it over my head. The sleeves are weirdly long, so I roll them up and pull my briefs over my legs. My hair is getting long in the front. It curls down slightly on my forehead, but I can't decide if I want to cut it. I put some of Tessa's spray stuff in my hair and try to comb the unruly whiskers on my face. I like the scruffy look, but really wish I didn't have the patches of skin at the bottom of my cheeks that refuse to grow hair. By the time I'm dressed and my hair is somewhat tamed, I have a text from Nora. The only thing written is the address with a heart emoji, which makes me excited and a little more nervous. And which is also when I realize what time it is and that I need to hurry the hell up or I'll be late. I push my feet into my brown boots while I put the address into Maps on my phone, relieved that I can walk there in around 30 minutes. I use the walk to quiet my mind and try to think of interesting talking points to keep Nora and her friends somewhat entertained. God, I hope they're not into politics. Discussions about that never end well. I'm so preoccupied that I don't even notice that Dakota hasn't texted me back. Chapter 13. When I get to the club, it's smaller than I expected a nightclub to be. I've been to a club once in downtown Detroit that was twice the size of the brick building we are waiting in front of now. The setup of this club isn't like in the movies, where there's always an over-muscled, bossy man controlling the door, a guy whose little clipboard and earpiece hold the power to make or break the self-esteem of women who would never otherwise give him the time of day. A simple nod from him while he unhooks the velvet rope validates the 2 hours they have spent getting ready. If you're made to wait very long, you are nothing. That's what he wants you to feel like, anyway. And it's pretty messed up. It's all a charade, though. He still probably sleeps alone at night, and he doesn't feel any better about himself the next morning. His power trip has a 12-hour expiration date. After that, he still hates himself, and he's still mad that he didn't get that one big shot he deserved with the lady he pined for, or the phone number of that one hot woman he didn't make an effort to treat with any sort of respect. It makes me a little sad to know that in 2016, people still care about getting into nightclubs based on their looks. I try my hardest not to buy into that stuff, but I know it's what happens. That said, I'm extremely relieved that this place isn't like all that. The small red brick building is on the corner of the street, right next to a row of food trucks parked on a vacant lot. The street isn't as busy as the sidewalk, only a few green cabs and a Tesla drive by. While I'm watching the Tesla's black paint shine under the lights, a hand touches my arm. I look around to see Nora. Her eyes are made up, smoky gray makeup shadows them. She's wearing black pants that look as if someone painted them on her thick thighs. Her hips are hidden behind a black shirt with an Adidas symbol printed on it. It looks like she took scissors to the top of it, cutting a V-neckline into the soft cotton. She's wearing a black blazer over it and white tennis shoes. She looks casual and so put together and so out of my league. She's way too pretty. Too hot. Too everything. After Nora lets go of my arm, she just stands silently in front of me, seeming to be waiting on me. I don't know what to do, so I stare back at her. More than a few people join us on the sidewalk as we wait to go inside. Finally, she glances toward the door of the bar. "Shall we?" I nervously ask. Her shiny lips turn into a smile and she nods. I watch her eyes take in my outfit and I can't help but feel a little self-conscious about my choice of clothing. Should I have worn looser pants? Are the rolled-up sleeves too much? Nora's eyes finally leave my body and she looks over toward the plate glass window of the bar. "Yep. We shall." Then, pointing inside, she adds, "They already have a table." I feel like I look out of place. I text Tessa while I follow Nora to tell her I'm here. I feel a little bad that I pestered her into coming out with us via text. I know she would rather be in her bed reading the highlighted pages of her favorite book. She would much rather be buried under her blanket crying over the mistakes and regrets of these characters, wishing her relationship had ended like one of her novels. But lying in bed being miserable isn't good for her. Besides, I could use another familiar face in this unfamiliar territory. When the door of the club opens, smooth electric music tumbles out onto the sidewalk. The beat is nice, slow yet fast, soft but complicated. I speed up and take an extra step to get closer to Nora to try to make conversation. So do you dance here much? I ask as we enter. She turns and runs her index finger down the center of my lips. No one dances here. She smiles at me the way a mother smiles at her child when she has to explain the simplest logic to them. When I look around, I realize it's not a club at all. Why the hell did I not just Google the name of the joint? The place is a typical hip hangout, and it's crowded. Small wooden tables, dark lighting, industrial theme. Groups of people congregating at the bar, laughing and downing handcrafted cocktails. A man with white hair shakes a tumbler of neon-colored liquid and everyone watches, cheering him on as he pours it over a bed of ice. It sizzles and a cloud of smoke rises from the cup. I'm impressed. As we walk up to the bar, I look at Nora and watch her expression change from curiosity to complete skepticism. Barkeep, that's the lamest trick in the book, she yells, loud enough for the bartender to hear her over the music. I look from side to side, taking in all the faces turned to us now. Nora doesn't turn away. She stares straight into the man's eyes when he turns toward her.
Ugh, I should have known that was you.
His expression is pure annoyance, but it's all pretend. The way he doesn't stop looking at her, I know that he knows her quite well, enough to tease her. Briefly and irrationally, I wonder if they've dated. Or maybe dating now. She smiles and leans against the bar. Hey, Mitch. She's using the bar top as a shelf for her chest, and he notices. He clearly likes it. I watch him stare, unashamed at her open cleavage. Her shirt is just so low, the neck cut into a V-shape is very distracting, and in combination with those damn jeans, I've never seen anyone look so good in such a simple outfit. Don't scowl, it doesn't suit you, Tessa chimes in my ear. Am I that transparent? I straighten out my face and try to rationalize this. I've never been a jealous person. Dakota would have driven a jealous person totally insane with her flirty personality and the pull she seemed to have on every guy at our high school.
She did a good job at never making me feel like I had to fight for her. She was always mine, and I didn't feel the need to be immaturely jealous or dramatic over it.
When did you get here? I ask, distracting myself from staring at Nora. Just now. Work was weirdly dead. She sighs, shrugging her shoulders like she would rather be anywhere but here. She's in her work uniform, black pants and a button-down white shirt. Her apron strings are hanging out of her purse. What a trooper and a friend. Horny bartender prances over, his smile wide and his hair perfectly coiffed. I'm sure he's nice. He has the shoulders of a linebacker and the build of Adam Levine. He's a tiny thing, yet muscular. It's an odd combination, but I can see the appeal. Nora stretches over to hug him, and he leans over into her arms. The bar is the only thing keeping the two of them from full body contact. I look away and pretend to scan the scene, but out of the corner of my eye, I can see that they are still hugging. I look around the place. All of the names on the drinks are written in chalk on a big blackboard behind the bar, and when I hear Nora order two of them, I look them up. Letters to Your Lover contains gin, raspberry, and something that I can't read. The Not-So-Manhattan is a blend of whiskey, vermouth, and bitters. A little hand-drawn knot is doodled next to the handwritten ingredient list. I continue to read through the quirky list of crafted cocktails, assuming that since Nora is about 25 and definitely knows the bartender, we won't have any problem getting served alcohol. I don't drink often. A six-pack would last me a month, probably. But I would like a drink tonight. Tessa and I have gone out a few times, and when we were offered a cocktail menu, we often managed to get drinks without being carded. Yeah, we walk on the wild side every once in a while. Tessa looks out of place as she tugs on the bottom of her baggy white shirt. I'm going to the bathroom, she says, and I nod and stand awkwardly in place, waiting for Nora to remember that I'm here. I stare at Mitch, and he keeps getting more and more attractive, and more obnoxious. Shouldn't he be making drinks or something? Now it's just me, Nora, and one of the most attractive men ever created. These types of men are brought into the world to make guys like me feel inadequate. His teeth are so straight and whiter than a new pair of sneakers. I look at them again, tilting on the heels of my boots and trying not to stare. Maybe I should have taken a bathroom break with Tessa. You know, like girls do. Before I can walk away, Nora breaks off from Mr. Hot, who's too hot to work at a small bar, and links her arm through mine. Her hands are cold when she touches my skin. I reach for them, take them in mine, and rub them together. They warm up almost immediately, along with my cheeks, which are burning at my forwardness. Thank God it's dark in here. She looks up at me, her eyes curious. She looks down at our hands, at my gesture, and smiles. The lights suspended from the ceiling are moving, casting shadows and casting light on her body. The exposed skin of her neck and chest is glowing under their slow dance. She's staring at me, and I'm staring at her, and I can't stop. I look over at Mr. Hot, and he's not paying any attention to us. I sort of wish he would. I wish he could see this. What's wrong with me? I've got to stop talking to Harden so much. He's turning me into an asshole. A neurotic asshole. Nora keeps eye contact with me.
Let's go sit down.
It's slightly unsettling, keeping eye contact with anyone, especially a beautiful girl who I've already sort of admitted that I'm attracted to. When she kissed me, my body responded in a way that had me convinced my body had always been waiting on her. On such a kiss. She turns back to the bar, thanks Mitch, and then hands me a drink with a strand of red licorice tied into a knot in it. There's a little stick in the drink with an upside-down skyscraper on the end of it. It appears to be made from wood. I'm impressed. Nora's drink has a little note clipped on its side. I'm going to assume that it's a little letter. I'm doubly impressed. Nora continues to stare at me, and I remember that she said we should sit down. I nod, wanting to move away from the crowded bar area. The row of tables looks pretty crowded too, but at least we can sit down there. The music is nice, low and steady with a good beat.
There's no dance floor. It's a cocktail bar that has a small snacks menu, not a nightclub.
I still can't believe I didn't just look up the place instead of overthinking it. Nora wraps her fingers around my wrist and leads me toward the back of the bar. The space gets darker and darker the farther we move away from the bar, and finally we stop at a table full of women who look up and smile and nod at us. It still amazes me how close to one another people are willing to sit in this city. The small tables are all lined up next to each other, and you can hear everything the people around you are saying, though the music is so loud that it may not be a problem. A few of the seats at the table are empty, and Nora gestures for me to sit down at one. She sits across from me and raises her drink to mine. Clinking our glasses, I poke at the licorice and at the little wooden building and move them out of the way before I take a drink. Holy hell, this tastes like gasoline! I somehow knew that it would. I smile at her, but shake my head and wave my hands over the drink. I'm gonna sit this one out. She laughs, covering her mouth and nodding. I don't blame you. He made them strong. She pushes a tumbler full of water toward me with a smile. She grabs my drink and sniffs.